So it is 9:17 on Saturday night. I'm sitting on my front steps. It's really beautiful out. Clear skies. Sun just went down. So today we were asked by our city council member to really just kind of watch out for ourselves, recognizing that the National Guard will be here, but we cannot count on them to show up for us. We've already been called twice tonight to confront people at the bakery. It's called Turtle Bread. I can hear explosives and horns honking. It's kind of crazy.
Overnight, authorities in Minneapolis fought back.
We begin tonight with a nation already on edge in the coronavirus pandemic as protests turn violent across America.
This morning, Minneapolis is reeling, tensions running high in a city on edge.
Bail was set at $500,000 for fired Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who was arrested Friday. Chauvin is facing third-degree murder and manslaughter charges in connection with Floyd's death. The other three fired officers have not yet been charged.
I'm Jeremy Siegel. This is Politico Dispatch, and today, as protests over the death of George Floyd continue across the country, a conversation with an activist who says he and other black demonstrators in Minneapolis have had enough, and a journalist who is stretched thin covering protests and violent clashes in the city where it all began.
They're in the street because they have no choice. That this is a horrible society, that young people feel like the only way they can get some attention is by taking to the streets.
My name is Mel Reeves. I am an activist, organizer, and journalist.
They've been brought to the street by what happened, not because they just decided, oh, we want to just get out and disturb your peace. We'd much rather be doing something else.
Protesters taking to the streets, as we said, for a fourth straight night, this despite an 8 p.m. curfew imposed by the city.
I think a lot of people, you know, have been seeing videos of the protests in Minneapolis and other cities on social media or on, you know, cable news, hearing pundits talking about what's going on. But how would you describe what is happening in your community right now?
Right now, people are continuing to protest. What's going on is there's a concerted effort to get the power structure, the city of Minneapolis, the county of Hennepin, and the state of Minnesota to do what anybody else should have done already, what people would have done in a humane society, organized around the needs of human beings, and that is when one human being takes the life of another human being, or a group of human beings takes the life of another human being, especially for no good reason, they would be punished. And so people organized so that these all four of the officers would be charged with what they should be charged with, which is first-degree murder.
How would you describe, like, what it's been like, you know, on the ground at the protests? Like, what the people around you are saying, what they're doing, sort of what the experience has been like for you there demonstrating?
You know, amazingly, people are speaking with one voice. Everybody is determined to get justice for George Floyd. You talk to people on the ground, you ask them why they're there, look at you like you're stupid. Hey, I'm here because I want to get justice for George Floyd. And they're very clear about what justice means. In fact, I was at two, there were three rallies yesterday, and all three, the cry was all four, justice means all four of them going to jail and being charged with murder. People are united in what they want and why they're attending the protests.
I mean, with that in mind, every time there is a shooting death like this, we hear calls from people for change. And, you know, a lot of people sort of suddenly become aware of racism and anti-racism or are talking more about it in the media, on TV, in everyday life. But at the same time, not a whole lot seems to change. I mean, you know, even since Tysel Nelson or Philando Castile, like, how are you hoping that this time will be different? What will it take for things to really change here?
Jeremy, the absolute honest question now that nobody wants to face is the entire system has to be changed. It's right in front of us now, right? We saw it with the pandemic. You know, some things happen that have you scratching your head. Why would employers put people's lives at risk? So nothing short of system change is going to stop the police abuse and police terror. Nothing short of system change. Folks have fought for reform. Years ago, we had something called the Civilian Review Board here, and they slowly but surely took it back and slowly but surely disbanded it and got rid of it. So if they, when they do make reforms, they slowly but surely go back to where things were. So there's nothing short, nothing will change this short of a system change. We don't change the system because the reforms don't work. They have not worked. Every time folks try, they go right back, which tells us that the police have a reason for operating. There's a reason that the police do what they do.
How do you think, you know, for people who are seeing some of the issues that you're raising and want to do something about it, how do we have effective protests for something like this? Because, you know, for some people watching the protests we've seen across the nation, some of them have been underscored by violence or instances of destruction. I mean, in these situations, do you think violence impedes the conversation that should be happening about racism and police violence? Or do you think it's a necessity for, you know, getting the attention that's needed on the issue?
Well, as the young people are trying to tell you, they're beyond conversation. People are saying that what caused the city, the county to give in was the fires that occurred on, what, Wednesday night. Now, Thursday, we had a protest that I helped organize downtown. We marched, 5,000 people through downtown, right? And we were peaceful. And I like to think that that protest is what twisted their arm. But most people tell you, they think it was the fires. I can't argue with them. You know, I can't argue with them because we got nothing. But wait. Wait. But the Thursday night, they burnt again. And next thing you know, oh, we're going to charge. All of a sudden, he's in custody. And then they charged him. And that happened after there was the burning and the looting and the so-called violence. There wasn't really violence. It was the police that were violent. The police are violent on a regular basis, not the people. Young people are responding because they are angry. They are ticked off, as they should be. They have had enough. And this happened in the middle of a pandemic. Remember, some of these young people's mothers and fathers got sick because of it, especially some of the Black folks. Their parents were essential workers that were not cared for, that were not protected. People are mad about that already. You got to remember that. So this is a response. I won't really call it violence on some level. This is a response to the violence, the everyday violence on some level that these people experience in this society. And at some point, if you keep pushing somebody and pushing somebody and pushing somebody, they sure as heck will push back.
Mel Reeves, thanks so much for talking with me.
If I can, Jeremy, I'd like to leave this quote with folks.
Yes, of course, of course.
Early this month was the birthday of Malcolm X, and he said something that I think is relevant for what's going on now. He says that there will ultimately be a clash between the oppressed and those who do the oppressing. He said, I believe that there will be a clash between those who want freedom, those who want justice and equality for everyone, and those who want to continue the system of exploitation. I believe that there will be that kind of clash, but I don't think it will be based on the color of the skin. And what you notice out here, Jeremy, is that the majority of the protesters have been white. And so that tells you that even white people are tired. A lot of young white people are tired of this system. And that speaks a lot. This has been a multiracial, right? Speaking of anti-racism, this has been a multiracial, multi-ethnic fight. And I think that's a significant thing. I think we're going to get to the point where everybody is going to get tired of this systemic injustice that forces us into the street. Thanks.
It's been an interesting experience being a journalist here in the Twin Cities on and off for the past 10 years. My name is Ricardo Lopez, and I'm a senior political reporter for the Minnesota Reformer here in St. Paul, Minnesota. I was a political reporter for the Star Tribune here for about 3 years when the Black Lives Matter movement took off after the death of Michael Brown. Minneapolis quickly had its own incidents in 2015 and in 2016 with the deaths of Jamar Clark and Philando Castile. So those deaths brought a lot of the same protests and demonstrations, but never to the degree that we saw happen this week. And I think a lot of the frustrations that have been felt is the fact that, you know, since then, there have been numerous examples across the country, but we still find ourselves here without having made any different changes as a result of those deaths. And in the case of Jamar Clark, those officers did not face charges. In the case of Philando Castile, he was charged, but ultimately acquitted. And so here in Minnesota, it's been very difficult to hold any police officer accountable because of the state law. And so that's been a political battle that has never really been won by people who want change with policing.
And Ricardo, for our listeners there, you're referring to a statute that gives police wide discretion on when to use deadly force in Minnesota. But a lot of this has come to a head in these protests that have sparked, you know, similar action in cities across the nation. And you've been out there covering them. What is the message you're hearing from demonstrators on the ground in the city where all of this began?
Well, you're hearing two messages, I think, both being made at once. Yesterday, there was this assembly of community and faith leaders across, you know, different ethnicities. There was Somali leaders, there was Latino leaders, there were Jewish faith leaders and others who came together to basically, you know, express their frustration, their anger, their sense of injustice at this systemic problem that has long existed here, but also at the same time pleading for the preservation of this community, because, you know, at the point that it became so destructive and this fear that there were outside people here intent on hijacking the protests, you know, that was a very nuanced message that emerged. And I think what you saw was overnight a massive police presence that largely quelled a lot of the activity that happened the night before. So I think that was very striking to have happen yesterday and see it play out the way it did overnight.
You mentioned outsiders potentially coming in for these protests. I mean, a number of officials from Minnesota's governor up to the president have talked about that and outsiders being to blame for the violence and destruction we've seen in some protests. You know, they've talked about different groups, white nationalists or far right groups coming in to incite things, others pointing to activists on the left. Is that something that you yourself have seen in Minneapolis?
Yes. I mean, I've seen evidence and my colleague also on the ground has, you know, seen evidence of white agitators or instigators. And there have been other documented instances by other reporters on the ground. We learned that a lot of calls were being placed about vehicles throughout the metro with out-of-state license plates. In the midst of all this, it's kind of hard to sort out exactly which perhaps extremist ideology is in the mix here, because it could be potentially left and right wing. But at this point, it's too hard to say. But politically, I think people are depending on whether you're liberal or you're trying to push the Antifa idea as the president is doing, I think it's too early to say at this point.
I mean, on top of that, there are also videos from over the past couple of days that appear to show police using pretty shocking force against protesters.
Video. It's from inside the protests a few hours ago in Brooklyn, okay?
From a, you know, police car bashing into protesters in New York.
It appears to drive directly into a barrier where a large number of protesters were gathered.
To the National Guard shouting, "Light them up," on a residential street in Minnesota before apparently shooting paint canisters at people on their porch.
Can you help?
You know, claims that law enforcement responding to this is being violent, responding aggressively or even inciting demonstrators. Is that something that you've seen or experienced firsthand?
Yes. I mean, I think, I was just kind of going through some of that footage that emerged overnight and seeing what happened here in Minneapolis with even journalists. I think you've seen individual police who have, you know, indiscriminately used mace on people. You've seen just live on video, journalists get arrested. Those are the questions that, you know, officials will be facing in the aftermath of this. I think here in Minnesota, for instance, the governor made it a big, you know, he exempted media here, but you had the incident with the state patrol, and they were responsible for what journalists are describing as an attack on them. A dozen reporters, videographers, and photographers who were cleared out near the 5th Precinct. They included reporter Molly Hennessy Fisk for the Los Angeles Times, who has documented what happened to her.
The Minnesota State Patrol was advancing on protesters and us. We identified ourselves as press, and they fired tear gas canisters on us at point-blank range. I got hit in the leg. I'll post a photo of that. We asked them, I was saying, where do we go? Where do we go? They did not tell us where to go. They didn't direct us. They just fired on us. We got stuck. Myself and the photographer got stuck in a corner.
I know, you know, as journalists, our job is to observe things. But I'm curious on your end, as a journalist of color, you know, these situations can be particularly difficult. And we've even, you know, we saw one journalist being arrested on the scene covering this. I'm curious, like, what personally has it been like for you covering these protests?
It really cuts at you, but we still have this job to do, right? And we feel this very differently, you know. And I think about my experience covering candidate Trump in 2016, and I was on the convention floor of the Republican National Convention in 16 when he was accepting the nomination. And I just go back to that moment, and I just remember that picture of America that he had painted as, you know, sort of carnage, and had these flashbacks to the 60s and everything that was happening then. And I just think this is a scary moment, because as someone who's Latino, especially at the time, who, you know, he was stoking all this division and rhetoric against immigrants, against Mexicans, right? And so I just remember the absolute hurt and pain and devastation I felt when the El Paso massacre happened, and thinking, for me, this racism that affects brown people, that affects black people, it's a lot of things at once. And I will confess, like, all week I've just, in general, just been running on adrenaline. I know at some point I'll, you know, this will all sort of slow down and I'll have a chance to sort of process. So yeah, I mean, it hits at us differently, and because we not only feel it, but we also have the burden of explaining to our white colleagues, to maybe white listeners, readers, what is happening and why.
Where do you think all of this is headed in the coming days, both specifically in Minneapolis, but also across the country in cities where Minneapolis has sparked similar action?
Well, put this in the context of, you know, past riots and unrest in the 60s and what happened then. You know, 30 years later, we had the LA riots almost. And here we are almost 30 years later. You know, I hope for change and I hope for improvement, but like many, we just haven't seen it yet. So anyways, I think that's a long-winded answer to say I don't know, but I hope something happens that betters it.
Ricardo Lopez, thanks so much for talking with me.
Absolutely.
And we reached out to Minneapolis police for comments on the claims Mel and Ricardo made about violence toward protesters and journalists, but did not get a response. Also today, the mass protests taking place across the country over the death of George Floyd are raising concerns about public health efforts to track and contain the spread of coronavirus. In order to trace exposure and alert people on whether they might have been infected, health experts need newly infected people to recount everyone they've interacted with over multiple days. But that process of contact tracing is extremely tough if someone's been to a large gathering of people. State and local officials have been working to continue easing shutdown orders, but health experts say reopening needs needs to be accompanied by widespread testing and contact tracing to prevent a new wave of the virus. It's unclear if protests themselves could trigger large spikes in cases. Experts say demonstrators have been outside, which is lower risk for spread, and many of the protesters have worn masks. But still, they worry public health efforts to contain the disease and trace its spread could be undermined. And President Trump says the U.S. government plans to designate Antifa as a terrorist organization, but it appears he does not have the legal authority to do that. Trump's push to crack down on Antifa, short for anti-fascist, comes as he and other top officials, including Attorney General Bill Barr, have blamed Antifa for violence and property damage to large and small businesses during the recent protests. Under current laws against terrorism, the State Department can designate foreign organizations as terrorist groups, but the U.S. cannot designate purely homegrown groups as terrorist organizations. Shortly after Trump announced the effort on Twitter on Sunday, Attorney General Barr released a statement that did not mention the president's tweet directly, but said, quote, "The violence instigated and carried out by Antifa and other similar groups in connection with the rioting is domestic terrorism and will be treated accordingly," and that the FBI's joint terrorism task forces would work to identify suspects. The task forces have faced criticism for monitoring domestic political groups, and a 2010 Inspector General report found that some of their reasons for opening investigations of domestic groups were, quote, factually weak. This episode was made with production help from Annie Reese and editing by Irene Noguchi. If you like the show, subscribe to Politico Dispatch wherever you get your podcasts, and if you can, leave us a rating and review. I'm Jeremy Siegel. Thanks for listening.